Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks so much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. My day job is to write and speak about current events, but I'm a history buff, like I'm sure many of you are. Conservatives, in fact, tend to be history buffs, while progressives aren't big fans of history, perhaps because history too often demonstrates and exposes the catastrophic failure of their ideas and agenda. In fact, progressives are more focused on rewriting the inconvenient past than they are learning from it. They're more focused on cutting our young people off from their history and their cultural legacy. Anyway, I'm also a bit obsessive about books, and today my guest is the author of a new book that dives deep into a lot of American history that even I don't know about, and yet ties it closely to current events and places them in a really fascinating, broader historical context. The book is called Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left, and it really grabs you from page one all the way to the end, taking you on a journey that will leave you much better educated and wiser about the political battles that we're facing today. It doesn't hurt that the author is a brilliant writer who manages to weave all of these historical insights into gripping stories about the larger-than-life characters and the epic conflicts of the first century of our nation's history, from the Revolution through the Civil War. I've known the author for a long time, and I've been eager for this chance to bring him on and share his insights. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so that you can keep up with the great conversations we're having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at The Right Take is a friend and colleague at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. If you're a regular reader of Front Page Mag, then you know that he's an absolutely brilliant and impossibly prolific political commentator. He's a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the Center, as well as the Executive Director of Programming there. He's just published his long-awaited first book, Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers' Fight Against the Left. I have read it and reviewed it for Front Page Mag, although the review won't run until next week. But needless to say, the book is as profound and informative as you would expect from the amazing Daniel Greenfield. Daniel, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we get to your book, Daniel, let me get your take on a current event that's kind of dominating the news right now. Could I get your thoughts on this, what I call these campus intifadas that are taking place all over the country, and this escalation of pro-Hamas, anti-Israeli, and anti-American fervor? Do you see all this burning out quickly, or is it ratcheting things up to a whole new level of tense and dangerous internal political conflict?
Well, we have to take into account the larger context. And we have a very intriguing lineup, which is that you tend to have these riots these days, which we've come to accept as normal, around elections. It's not a coincidence. You know, this when it came to BLM, did no drug dealers get shot on off years? For some reason, when they got shot on off years, it was not a big deal. It was a big deal on election years. So this is specifically a two-pronged effort. On the one hand, obviously, it's meant to boost Democrat turnout, particularly with the BLM riots, with other protests, or alternatively, and sometimes together, it's also meant to impose pressure and radicalize the Democrats even further. And this fits the profile for both. So I think they've been very clear that they want to keep this going. They want to keep this going into certainly the convention. They want a repeat of the 68th convention. They want to bring some terror to Chicago. And they want to maintain pressure as much as they can. If somehow the war ended, they'd have to switch to something else. But the bottom line is they almost certainly would either keep it going, even if the war ended, or they would switch to some other cause that they'd be blocking traffic and vandalizing things for. Because if you remember in the past few years, yes, it's been BLM. It's also been abortion. It's also been the environment. And you've got all these groups that are kind of there. They're ready to go on all these various causes. And it's just a question of which group is taking the lead at any time. We've got environmental groups involved in this. We've got the same, you know, Rainbow Coalition of LGBTQ and various minority groups, and they're all kind of just prepping to go for a particular cause, but the cause itself matters less than the need to maintain the state of perpetual radical terror.
Do you think all this radical terror is actually helping the Democrat Party come election time, or is it turning a lot of, we'll say, independents off, or maybe even some Democrats? Are they starting to wake up to the radicals in their midst?
It's not helping the Democratic Party per se, but it is helping the left, and the left cares a lot more about its own cause. It is much more comfortable losing an election in order to radicalize the Democrats than it is winning an election to moderate it. That was the lesson of 68. It's been the lesson all along. If you put the left in the driver's seat, it will focus on radicalizing and pushing its followers to adopt more and more extreme views and beliefs in order so that when they do actually come to power, they're going to implement the left's agenda. And that's what we've seen over and over again. They will sabotage elections if need be, so long as they are the ones actually in power once the dust settles.
Okay, let's talk about your brand new book, Domestic Enemies, because there's so much to get to there. I know I speak for your many readers when I say I'm excited about this book. It's not so much a current events kind of a book as it is a deep dive into early American history, and yet you make many enlightening connections with what is happening in America today. Can you just tell people what the book is about?
So the book is Domestic Enemies, The Founding Fathers Fight Against the Left. And yes, while it is very much set in history, it is important to understand that these are the events that are still going on today. And in part, it was inspired by the 1619 Project because they created this entirely fictional history of America's origins, and that created the actual origins of the left. But it was also important to look at what was going on back then when I was writing this. You had the pandemic and the lockdowns. Then you had the race riots in order to influence an election. You had election rigging. So all those things are actually in the book. And the book shows how these things were going on. They were happening in 1800. They were happening during the Civil War. And these are just the same tactics being repeated over and over again, which provides also a certain amount of comfort because we have faced these crises before. It's not just a history book. This is a very interesting factoid here. There's a very interesting factoid there. But what does that do for our current crisis? Well, our current crisis is really rooted in these past crises that are repeating over and over again.
I guess your book sort of proves the point that Mark Twain, at least reportedly, said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I guess there are a lot of political battles that we're facing today which rhyme with these battles that America has faced in the past. Can you tell us briefly how the Democrat Party's origins are rooted in the French Revolution of 1789 and how the early American left dreamed of bringing that revolution, that revolutionary model, to our own shores?
So a lot of the current state of the left is very much due to the rise of the Soviet Union and the wave of enthusiasm that revolution into America. Succeeding radical leftist takeovers, whether it was in Cuba, China, so on and so forth, definitely spurred new waves of radicalism. And you can really connect the dots on all of those things together. I mean, I'm living in a city, L.A., which has Mayor Karen Bass, who was volunteering for Cuban front groups to go to Cuba. But the same thing was going on with the French Revolution, which was really ground zero for this entire idea, because the French Revolution was more than just about overthrowing the monarchy. You increasingly had more and more radical figures on the left taking over and began implementing this larger vision for transforming society. At one point, they abolished religion. They created their own cult of the supreme being that was very quasi-pagan. They created their own calendar. They were going to start everything from year zero, start everything from scratch, which is, of course, the great vision of the left. And, of course, all that very quickly turned into mass murder. And there were leftist Americans, and a lot of people have trouble believing that there was a left before the 1960s and 1920s. And that's one of the things this book addresses. There very much was one. They wanted to bring this to America, and their vehicle for doing that was something called the Democratic Societies. These groups were named by one of the agents of the French Revolution, who was here to help take down George Washington and bring America, make America a puppet of the left and of the French regime, more specifically. So the Democratic Societies eventually evolved partially into what became the Democratic Republican Party, which means the origins of the Democratic Party, the granddaddy of the Democratic Party, was tied to the radical left. It was tied to foreign globalist influence. So it's not surprising that we're still dealing with these same things because we're still dealing with the same original causes.
Exactly. I found that part of the book to be really fascinating. And even though the French revolutionaries had our model, the American Revolution, as a model, they saw it as incomplete. You write that these two revolutions ushered in two very different approaches that define today's world. What were and are those different approaches?
So you could kind of dumb down the Founding Fathers' model to basically being, leave me alone. We're going to have various independent systems that are going to work together. But overall, the average American does not really have to spend a lot of time thinking about the government. And the government's purview extends to matters that are, you know, within the community or beyond the community. Certainly a fundamental primary purpose of a federal government was to protect the borders, something that the federal government now refuses to do entirely. But it was not about controlling how you lived, what you thought about, and your day-to-day lives. It was not that, but the French Revolution was very much that. French Revolution was pursuing its own ideal, which was to create this perfect people. And that is what leftist revolutions invariably do. They try to create this ideal people to match their ideal ideology. The Founding Fathers' ideology could be summed up as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which was the idea that government had its own very constrained sphere, and the larger purpose of that sphere was to enable people to be able to live their own lives. It was not to create a people. The government was subsidiary to the people, whereas in leftist revolutions, the people always become subsidiary to the government. So you had these two very different models that we're still dealing with today. And if we think about what the left wants to do today, they want to create this perfect people. They may, you know, from year to year, change the descriptions, the buzzwords. You know, we're going to put equity at the center of everything we do. We're going to have diversity. We are going to transform the educational system, but all of it really ultimately comes down to the same idea that the government will shape the people into who the government ideologues believe they should be.
The American left in the early days of American history, just like the French left, they wanted revolution, but as you write in the book, they learned to scale back as a strategy from this kind of, as you put it, apocalyptic utopianism to radical change through incremental progress, a sort of a revolution in stages from within the system. Can you talk about that change a little bit?
So we have the so-called radical left and the moderate left. And I say so-called because much of it is really a tactical difference. And this is the same tactical difference we saw after the 60s, after the various protests and riots petered out. And it became clear that there was not going to be this big violent overthrow when heirs and the weather underground were contemplating their own revolutions. They thought they were actually going to seize power and the North Koreans and the Chinese and all the other communist regimes would come in and help them occupy America. It was like their version of Red Dawn, except they were taking this seriously. Then they realized this was not happening. They went into academia. Ayers, for example, became an education professor, and they went into politics and government, and they began taking control of the system internally. And the big revolutionary ideas clearly was something that the left had tried and had failed to accomplish in America for two centuries. Most Americans were not interested in a really dramatic radical transformation. So what the left did was they broke it up into bite-sized pieces. They would identify a problem, let's say poverty or child labor, and they would offer this smaller solution. The solution almost invariably involved some new government agency, some new government arm empowered to deal with the problem. That is still, you know, how they tackle every problem today. We need more funding for this arm of the government. We need to create a new entitlement. And the upshot of this was you were creating a bigger and bigger administrative state, and you're also giving it more and more power. The Civil Rights Act is one of the worst examples, where they stepped in to remedy obviously horrifying abuses, but rather than remedying it by eliminating the abuse of government, they created an entire infrastructure for government abuses, which then became itself unlimited in scope. The Civil Rights Act, for example, extends now to virtually everything. The Biden administration is now using variations of it to go ahead and say that every business now must allow men to use the ladies' room if they identify as women. So you have these, you know, it's obviously not something that people in the 60s would have remotely gone ahead with. And they would have said, good Lord, no, we are absolutely not for this. But if you break it up into sections, if you immediately say, no, we are remedying segregation by doing this, and it seems, well, okay, segregation is a great evil. We should remedy this. This makes sense. But the revolution continues going and going. The power of government continues expanding. And the things that were unacceptable 50 years ago, 40 years ago, even 10 years ago, now become the next item on the agenda. And people have now been conditioned to accept it because it's incremental change.
Let me drill down a little bit into a couple of specific stories and chapters in your book. It's probably hopelessly old-fashioned today for me to say something like this, but George Washington is a kind of a personal hero of mine. And I don't want you to give away too many spoilers about the book, but can you tell us how, as you write in the book, how globalists in his era used fake news to take down George Washington?
George Washington is a hero of mine. There are one or two quotes of his that I use on a regular basis. So, yes, this is actually quite compelling because in our history, we kind of have this idea that George Washington was elected by acclamation and he governed largely trouble-free with the general approval of the public. And that's true to an extent. There were obviously various crises, but more importantly, the left absolutely hated Washington. It viewed him as blocking their dreams of revolution. One of the things we failed, for example, to connect with the farewell address, where he warns about foreign entanglements, is that the left was obsessed with supporting the French Revolution, which back then the vision was this French Revolution was not just going to be in France, it is going to spread around the world, it's going to spread to America, it's going to spread really from certainly all across Europe, it's going to take down all the various monarchies, and it's going to eventually encompass the world. That's the vision they had, much as they did with the Communist Revolution. So George Washington is there. He's serving as an obstacle because he is avoiding this kind of entanglement with the French Revolution. He's refusing to let the proponents of the French Revolution turn America into a puppet regime of the left. So they set out to destroy him. And one vector is a simply violent protest. And there are violent protests. Later, John Adams writes that tens of thousands are protesting in the streets of Philadelphia, demanding that he be removed from office. Adams is probably exaggerating at this point. He's pretty elderly, and he might be mistaking. It was probably not tens of thousands, but certainly there were these leftist mobs that were being drawn in to implement the French Revolution here in America. And beyond that, the violent protests didn't work. What they did do was they tried to destroy George Washington by the usual means of propaganda, by demonizing him. Trump was the first guy that they tried to destroy. In reality, we look back, they did this. They ran this game on every Republican, no matter good or bad, conservative, rhino, it doesn't matter. I had an article back in the day where I showed how they accused every single Republican presidential candidate of being just like Hitler. And they started this with George Washington. He was really, they won because George Washington was a national hero. And how do you go ahead and destroy a national hero, especially a man who's humble and modest and who is widely admired? So they start using some of the first propaganda newspapers. Until that point, a lot of the purpose of newspapers was really advertising, this ship is coming in with this cargo, that ship is coming in. And the Democrats really revamped them the party still hadn't really evolved, and later would be the Democratic Republicans, but really the leftists of the era turned them into scurrilous hit pieces. And they learned a good deal from what the French were doing. Some of them had actually been involved in the French Revolution and the various European radical movements. Some of these people were actually immigrants. So they brought this expertise, these more sophisticated European ways of running newspapers, and deployed them to demonize George Washington, to repeatedly claim that he's actually plotting to seize power, to become a king, that we need to remove him urgently, that if we don't remove him, we're going to be at war with France, and there is generally going to be a state of misery and disaster, and we're going to be right back with a monarchy. They call for his execution. They really depict this through cartoons and poems and talking about him being led to the guillotine. So they throw everything they have at him. In the long run, it does not stick. It does stick when they target Adams, who is a much more vulnerable figure, who is much more controversial. But they absolutely make George Washington miserable. He's absolutely in disbelief because he's still an honorable Southern gentleman. He's in disbelief of what they're doing to him. And it variously infuriates him. It embitters him. He has to be talked more and more into even staying in office. So in part, what they do does succeed, but it also triggers a reaction. One of those is Alexander Hamilton, who is probably the closest person to Washington, who goes ahead and ends up creating something that is going to become the New York Post. And the New York Post is actually one of the oldest, if not the oldest, major newspapers in America, and it's specifically created to fight back against this array of fake news, much of it that's actually being fed by French agents, by France, by French allies, in order to bring down George Washington.
Very interesting. And the notion that Washington was secretly plotting to make himself king is just a ridiculous inversion of the truth, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It's somewhat apocryphal, but King George III was said to have observed that if George Washington actually steps down, leaves office after taking office, he'll be the greatest man who ever lived. That quote is possibly apocryphal, but the larger idea is George Washington created this model for a leader who steps up in a crisis, who serves out his term, leaves office, does not seek any more power, and he absolutely was this ideal figure, if I can gush for a moment, because he absolutely did not want power. He did not want any of the roles that had been thrust upon him, but when really he was told that the country would go under if he did not step forward, he would step forward. Despite hating it, he had absolutely no desire to be president. He had absolutely no desire to be at the top, yet he did his duty nonetheless.
Your chapters are arranged in brief time periods from the American Revolution through the Civil War. I've got to say, I love this chapter title, 1825 to 1840, Communist Sex Cults Come to America. Can you talk a little bit about that chapter?
So again, socialism is something we associate with the 20th century, maybe the very late 19th century. Not at all the case. It dates back quite a while. And communes is also something we kind of associate with the 60s. You mentioned communes to someone, and yes, they think of all the usual 60s, 70s stuff. In reality, communes date back quite a while. Really, they're at the core of these various leftist utopian experiments. And they start setting them up in America very early on. As you mentioned, that the chapter header begins with the 1820s. And the reason they start doing that in America is because America is very ideal. There's a lot of space. There are places that are really not properly policed. And they're ideal for these European leftists, some American leftists, to go off and have their social experiments and try to build their utopias, which, of course, never work out. And part of the chapter chronicles how these communes failed. And by the way, when I say communes and communist sex cults, these communes set out to, among other things, abolish private property and marriage. That was one of the first things they tackled. And the people who lived in them were known as communists. That kind of sometimes blows people's minds. The people who lived in the communes were communists, and they had these ideal alternative lifestyle settings, which never worked. They all fell apart invariably. But what happened was the people who had these experiences, much like in the 60s and 70s, they went out, they went into institutions, they tried to bring some of those same values that had failed. In these communes, they tried to bring those into society in general. And the second half of the chapter really tracks what happened when they left these failing communes and they actually went into America at large and went into urban politics and began restructuring systems, including the public education system, to suit these agendas.
Another chapter that I found really fascinating is the one about how the Democrats set off America's worst race riots to steal the 1864 election. That sounds pretty relevant to our own time. Can you talk a bit about that chapter, about how the Democrat Party unleashed these race riots and terrorism in what you call one of the most pivotal battles of the Civil War?
Absolutely. I was writing this during the whole Black Lives Matter era, so it was incredibly relevant, especially because we've been handed all this botched history, which insists that the left, the Democrats, were all about civil rights. In practice, they were not. They were only interested in organizing, weaponizing people who would be willing to engage in violence for them. So there was a point at which they decided that Black nationalists and Black communist groups were the most effective tools for doing so. But long before that, they were using a whole other set of tools. And one of the things we really don't talk about much when it comes to Civil War, which we have this very black and white image, the good guys in the North in the blue uniforms and the bad guys in the South in the gray uniforms. And the reality is the situation was much more complicated. And a big part of that complexity was the Northern Democrats, who had a very, very different agenda, and particularly the leftists, many of whom were actually bent on maintaining the existing system of slavery, because, you know, as the arguments were made at the time, really slavery and socialism are actually pretty similar. Both of those have masters meant to impose their will on a population and shape them as they must. We briefly mentioned the situation in the previous chapter with some of these communes. One of those communes was actually literally, the Neshoba was literally utilizing slave labor. So when it came to the Civil War, they were also desperate to stop Lincoln. They were desperate to stop a Republican victory in the second term. And to do that, they did some of the same things that they did in 2020, which is what they deployed massive race riots. The New York draft riots are the best known of the riots. These were absolutely massive. You know, just as an example of how catastrophic they were, there's one of those favorite moments in the book where a Union Army captain seizes a piece of artillery and he asks for orders what to do with it. And this is happening in Manhattan, and he's told use it against the enemy. So this was really a large scale conflict. It utilized some of the same techniques of European socialist revolutions, which was to seize territory, declare an independent system, and begin consolidating control. It's some of the same things we're seeing on campuses now, where they're trying to seize territory, this whole CHASS principle. And New York was just part of a piece of a larger puzzle. They had a great Northwest conspiracy that was centered around Chicago, where in very Chicago style, they wanted to break out all the Confederate prisoners and have them vote in the Chicago election. And then they would also declare independence. So are these urban areas, are these urban political machines, New York, Chicago, other major cities, the left, the Democrats wanted to seize control of them and break them off and really transform America even more fundamentally. They did not get their way because the Union Army was able to push back. Lincoln was reelected, but arguably they did come pretty close. And these were riots. These were partially race riots. They were partially motivated by racism. But in the larger goal, they were just using everything they had in order to change the outcome of a presidential election. They failed to accomplish that during the Civil War, but they obviously did accomplish that in 2020. And we are living with the consequences right now.
And how did losing the Civil War mean that urban political machines replaced slave plantations as the at the heart of the Democrat Party?
So the Democrats had been this kind of coalition between two forms of what I would call cheap votes. You know, we have cheap labor, we have cheap votes. We know what cheap votes look like today. It's maintaining ghettos, bringing in massive amounts of illegal aliens and, you know, bringing them through the process as soon as possible so they can vote. It worked a little bit differently back then before the Civil War, but it was not so different. At the urban machine level, you brought in as many immigrants as possible. You subjected them to the worst kinds of degrading conditions. Even worse than the situation today, you had massive brothels, for example, that were run by the Tammany Hall, which was the Democratic Party. You had child labor on an almost unfathomable scale. And these people would all be pipelined through the Tammany Hall, through local urban political machines that would control the outcome. The only people who could win in districts controlled by these political machines were the political machines themselves. They actually engaged in violent gang warfare to prevent anybody else from voting, anybody else's votes from being counted. And then you had a similar system in its own way, which was slavery. Well, the people themselves, pardon me for a moment, the people themselves were not actually voting, but those districts were themselves bulked up by slaves because of the compromise. And we actually have something similar with illegal aliens. You know, one of the places where the Democrats pulled out all the stops under Trump was to make sure you wouldn't have the census question about citizenship, because you want to bring in all these illegal aliens, you want to bulk up all these districts, and you want to count, you want to break off all these districts based on this population of people who are not actually able to vote, not even legally here. So they were doing this to a degree with slave labor. And part of the system collapsed once slavery was ended, which meant that they had to rely on these urban political machines and these captive demographics, these captive districts even more. And that is still the system we have today. They don't have formally slave labor, but they have all these fake districts filled with people who are not even legally entitled to vote, whose votes really don't even count, but who are the basis for the Democratic power base in urban areas. You look at every presidential election, you see this vast territories of red, these vast territories where the majority of the votes are cast for Republicans, for conservatives. But then you look at these core urban areas, and suddenly those urban areas in many cases are outweighing territories that make up 99% of the country. And this is why they're able to do that.
I love that you end the book on this really rousing note of optimism, reminding people that we have faced these kinds of battles before and we've won them and that we can do it again. Because I think there's a streak of pessimism or fatalism sometimes in conservatives. And we can't really allow that to take us out of the fight. It's been a rough few years under the Obama 3.0 administration, but do you see signs that things are beginning to turn around in our favor politically and culturally?
Absolutely. This is a big part of why I wrote the book, because yes, there is absolutely the black belt effect, the sense of doom, the sense also that the America of Washington and Lincoln, of the founding fathers, all that is completely gone. They never faced crises like this. They would not have even been able to deal with it. And the reality is we faced crises like this from the beginning. And history, it's important to remember, does not operate in a straight line. A lot of people are discouraged because the conservative movement has not, the particularly Republicans, certainly Republicans themselves have not been very effective. But it is important to remember two things. One of those is the left does ultimately destroy itself. History does not go in a straight line. And the American people are not as stupid as some may think. Yes, they will vote for bad candidates in some cases. But when things turn the other way, the votes also turn around. And we are seeing this in the polls. I'm not saying the Republicans are running great campaigns. They're not. They're spending much of their time destroying themselves. Yet the public has turned on Biden. And we see this in polls over and over again. And it's important to really go back to the legacy of the founding fathers, which is trust the people. And, you know, we've gotten, a lot of us have gotten conditioned to distrusting the people, to thinking, you know, it is all in our hands. If we don't run better campaigns, it's not going to work. And yes, we should absolutely run better campaigns. We need to be a lot smarter, a lot better at doing things than we are. We've been sidetracked in so many ways that, you know, I could do a 1 hour talk on just that subject alone. But it's important to remember whether we do or we do not do. There is an American people that actually is in touch with the basic principles, even if they don't know them by heart, on which this country was founded. And one of those is basic self-interest. If the left continues hurting ordinary Americans enough, they will turn on them. And for now, we actually have a system in which it is possible for the people to rise up, that we should not take it for granted, because the left absolutely wants to eliminate that system. The founding fathers built all these safeguards to prevent them from doing that precisely because of it. The founding fathers were not ignorant of what the left was capable of. That is a message of the book. They built a system precisely to check those abuses. And we should strengthen that system. We should work with that system. And we should trust that system, because that system is still our best defense.
Yes. And I think that's a great place to end on. Daniel, tell people about your Salt and Knish blog, and also where they can find you on social media.
Well, obviously, I have the honor of working with David Horowitz, with you at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I also have my own blog, which I started now, it seems like a lifetime ago, post 911, which was called Salt and Knish. It's danielgreenfield.org now. And I'm on Twitter as Salt and Knish, and Daniel Greenfield on other places in social media where I still haven't been banned, but cross my fingers, I'll be banned tomorrow.
Yes, good to know. Daniel Greenfield, thank you for coming on The Right Take. Please keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Listeners, once again, I highly recommend Daniel Greenfield's book, Domestic Enemies. Get it wherever fine books are sold. You can find it, for example, at the Freedom Center store at frontpagemag.com. And thank you for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you can keep up with all the important conversations that we're having here. And again, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. It really helps, and I will be eternally grateful. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.